A surprising hit movie in 2023 called The Sound of Freedom was about international child sex trafficking. It featured a former Homeland Security official who discovered a sex trafficking ring in the line of his work, and he committed to freeing children caught up in it. According to UNICEF, the United States is one of the top destination points for victims of child sex trafficking and exploitation. Joining us to talk further is Dr. Jean Allert, the Executive Director of the Institute for Shelter Care, which equips Christian ministries with the knowledge, skills, tools, and community needed to provide exemplary restorative care to the sexually exploited. She's a former high school English teacher, member of the Department of Homeland Security Blue Campaign, a graduate of the FBI Citizens Academy, and a human trafficking contributor for the National Advisory Council for the Conference on Crimes Against Women. Jean, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters program.
Thank you.
Jean, I'd like to start with the surprise hit movie, as I just mentioned, The Sound of Freedom. My wife and I just watched this the other day, and quite frankly, it's jarring. It's about the former Homeland Security official Tim Ballard, who stumbled upon a predatory child sex trafficking ring. And in it, it showed clips of children being snatched up on the streets in Central American countries. And the whole movie is gripping. It's based on a true story. What I was curious about was, and one of the things I learned about as well, was that that's really not the typical way that children are brought into child sex trafficking. As alarming and as graphic and jarring as that is, of kids being snatched from the streets of Central American cities, that's not really how most kids get involved with child sex trafficking, is it?
No, it's not. But I will say that our movement is helped by films like Sound of Freedom, or if you go back a handful of years, the movie Taken, which helped to bring this issue to the public consciousness. But there is, we have to understand, a healthy dose of Hollywood to the way the stories are told. As we begin to be inspired and we say, okay, well, now my heart is pricked for the issue. Now let me engage my mind to better understand what it looks like. Domestically, what we see is that the number one form of recruitment in the United States is a relational connection, sometimes called the boyfriend method. But we have to understand that there are kids and women who have relational voids, fatherlessness, romantic voids, caregiver voids, and there are predatory individuals who will step into that void. So that's the number one most common form of recruitment. And that speaks a lot to what we understand about sexual violence in general, is that 70% or more of that is conducted by persons that the victim knows.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the family connection to child sex trafficking, particularly in this country. But going back to The Sound of Freedom, it was surprising in that it was the ninth highest grossing film at the box office last year. It took in about $250 million, which was eye-opening. And this did bring light to a very dark area, brought light to the reality that child sex trafficking happens, not just internationally, but here. One of the most difficult things for me to watch in that movie, and just a word of caution to the listeners and viewers of this program, that is a movie that will shake you. There's some things, and it was not, I think it was a PG-13, but just the whole idea that there's a market for children, that there's a pedophile, very active pedophile community, particularly in this country, and how children were used is particularly dark and just disturbing. So I caution any of the listeners and viewers that it's not something for the lighthearted. However, with that said, it did do a service to bringing light into the reality of what's going on. And Jean, my question is, as much as this was an eye-opening movie, what was challenging was just to see that there is a market and there's demand in this country. Pedophiles who are specifically looking for certain kinds of children. That was the other part. It was like these young children were staged just like cattle at an auction. And that disturbed me to my core. I had a hard time getting my mind around it, but just that there's a market for that. So how do we get to this place? I want to start with that. How do we get to this place? We're the wealthiest, freest, most prosperous country in the history of the world. And yet there is this market for deep, and sick perversion like this? How do we even get here? Because this does not happen in a vacuum, does it?
No, and it's oversimplification to say we're talking about sin, right? And we're talking about the sin that lies in the hearts of mankind. I think what's important to also understand from a psychological perspective is that this is not exclusively about sex. This is about power. This is about domination. There are other needs being satisfied and other, let's say, sinful desires that are being satisfied in these acts. And it can be, as one psychologist has written, that the perpetration against children, the motivation is the deflowering of the child, that the appetite is for the destruction of innocence. And so that is another element that we just as Christians have to hold on to, that there are people for whom that is their perversion. We also have to look intelligently at the sexual assault and child sexual assault data that the typical, unfortunately, perpetrator against children will have multiple victims, upwards of 300 victims, because the satisfaction is not derived necessarily in the sexual act, but it is in the power and control dynamic of the grooming process. So we have to understand that somebody who perpetrates particularly against children, but I would say vulnerable people in general, of which children are at the top of the pyramid of vulnerability, is there is that perverse satisfaction in having dominated someone else. And so that's another element that is so important for us to not get too caught up in the sexual side of it, but we have to understand the both and in terms of the motivation. Now, we also, unfortunately, have to hold simultaneously what's happening in our nation right now with the abject sexualization of children that we have, as you've discussed in other forums. The sexualization of children as young as kindergartners, whether that's through the media, the content, their schools, and all of those other forces that are bearing down to them. And that is, as perpetrators will say, doing half of the work for me. And so if I have a child who by the age of 8 has already been molested in the home, she's already been exposed to pornography continuously, she's in a school system where she's being told that, you know, you're a moneymaker and you should work it and you have to take care of yourself because the adults aren't doing it. Well, by the time she's 12, 14 years of age, it's a not a foregone conclusion, but it's a natural progression.
Yeah. I had a meeting along these lines of shaping the minds of our children and the expectations of our children. Met with somebody yesterday, concerned citizen in the Lexington area, who learned that a new middle school that's under construction right now is going to have gender neutral bathrooms. This is where we're talking 11 to 14 year old children, boys and girls, will be going into the same restroom area. The stalls are individual. But when did this become normal and okay, where you have boys and girls going into the stalls? And by the way, each of the stalls will have sanitary items for the young girls. I don't know what young boys, they don't know anything at that age anyway, but what are they supposed to do with that? To your point, this creates to the sexual confusion. There's the blurring of lines between male and female. And we're in the middle of a culture of sexual confusion and with identity issues. So Jean, I wanted to go back to this idea that this did not happen in a vacuum. I have made the case before that a culture that is awash in pornography and that objectifies women for their sexuality, it doesn't just end there, but there is a trajectory. It leads to other things. Can we make a case? I mean, is this where we end up when you normalize the objectification of women for their sexuality, when you market lust to men, when there's no moral or sexual boundaries anymore in a society? Is this the logical conclusion?
Well, almost flippantly, I could say, what else did we expect to happen? But not so flippantly, we know this to be true biologically. We know that our physiology as humans, we plateau, right? So if you take something like substance abuse and you talk about, oh, it's just marijuana, but marijuana at some point doesn't satisfy. We begin to acclimate to that level of substance. And so for many substance abusers, there is a continuing progression. I have to have more, either increased or rapidity or severity. And so we see that physiologically with the things that are harmful to us, is that we have to increase. We've seen that certainly with pornography. You know, in your and my lifetime, something that would be scandalous would be Lucy and Desi Arnaz, you know, in the same bed on TV. That was scandalous as a married couple. We have moved so far from that because each time, in a sociological way, we accept something, we begin to set that as the new threshold. And so then we have to get the next shock value, to get the next pleasure dopamine rush, to get the next sensory perception, we have to increase. And so we've just seen this happen with the sexualization of women and children in particular.
And now we're seeing the normalization of transgenderism. I think of one of the top shows last year, and whatever category it was, but it was RuPaul's Drag Race. It's about people dressing in drag. And here in Kentucky, I want to bring this to the state. You have drag shows that are coming to public areas. In Bowling Green last year, maybe a year and a half ago, there were drag queens who were using a public park during the middle of the day. I think of Owensboro, where there is a bar. It's a quasi-public private space subsidized by local government. And it's a place where drag shows are done regularly. So we see this normalization, to your point about a progression, where if you plateau, if you don't get your fix, you need something else. And it seems that not only is it with gender dysphoria, but as we're talking about with pedophilia and then the marketing of children. I think of one of the top stories in the news right now is Jeffrey Epstein and his island, and they were trafficking in children. And there's this list that's going to be released soon. And by the time this program airs, maybe we'll know some of the people on this list who are purported to be involved with that. And I guess I'm wondering, Gene, as you think about this, and as we talk about this progression, outrage has a shelf life. Now, I'm outraged and I'm shook and shaken just talking about this. But at what point do we lose the outrage and we're like, yeah, that's just normal, or this is just to be expected? And so, you know, I'm thinking right now of the people trying to talk this away, trying to explain it away. Well, it's not everybody, but it's some people. But the bottom line is we should be outraged and we should be moved when you talk about the level of evil and what's at stake here. How do we harness that outrage? How do we harness this moment that we're in as Christians in particular? And what do we do with that?
Yeah, I don't have the silver bullet answer to that, but I'm reminded of a police officer who had said to me back when I was in the Washington, D.C. area, and we were trying to wake up the Northern Virginia community in particular. And so think affluent community who is in their comfort and thinks that it doesn't happen within that area because they've sort of bought into that distancing narrative that, oh, that must be poverty situations or substance abuse or broken families or whatever it is that we use to distance ourselves from the problem. And this officer said, you know, the best thing that could happen to that community would be for them to have an actual case in their community that rocks their world. Well, almost prophetically, within about a year, the Northern Virginia area had a case of a sex trafficking ring that was gang related, that was taking girls out of very affluent high schools. I mean, these were girls, daddy's buying her a BMW for her graduation. So we're talking about the population you don't naturally assume. And they were being picked up after school, taken to motels, taken to strip malls, taken to locations. They were servicing customers and then being returned to their homes in the evening. And this went on for over a 3-year period. There were over 800 girls that had been exploited over that period of time. Now, that particular case rocked that community's world. And that was the jarring effect, the catalytic moment, if you will, that made them say, we've got to do something. And it also moved politically. And after that particular incident, or the awareness of that case that had gone unnoticed, The state government really stepped up, and Virginia radically changed their anti-trafficking laws, their child protection laws. They became one of the more strident in the nation. So unfortunately, my answer to you, Richard, is what we have seen nationally is when there is something that literally hits close to home. And that's where movies like Sound of Freedom and Taken can unfortunately do a disservice, because we can quickly say that's an over there problem. So I want to go back to what we do know domestically. My area of particular focus on this issue has been familial trafficking, as you introduced. And so we did a national study to find out what is the prevalence of familial trafficking. And for your listeners' benefit, that is a subtype of sexual exploitation where the perpetrator is related to the victim, usually an immediate family member. And this national data, which collected over 3,500 cases of child sex trafficking, found that anywhere between 26 to 47% of those child trafficking cases were at the hands of a caregiver, a family member. And that's legally defined as usually parent, step-parent, grandparent. And so within that child's immediate sphere of care, the perpetrator, most often from 60 to 68%, was the biological mother. And the most common motive for a biological mother, we'll use the generalities, for selling her child for sex to strangers or to other family members was to secure drugs. Now, that's changed over the last 4 years. 4 years ago, there's just not been much study of this, but 4 years ago, it was more often seen as economic motives. So what we have to do as responsible Christians is we have to start looking more seriously at the families who have the vulnerabilities of economics, of substance abuse, of other criminality, of domestic violence, dysregulation of those children being in any kind of consistent schooling or other forms of social services. And these are the populations that at least statistically present as being highly vulnerable. But as I continue the scare tactics, but it's all based on data, is that we also know that it is the affluent families too. We have to understand that the demand comes from that motive of entitlement. And that is really at the root of the demand side. I want, and therefore I should have. And if you add to that, and then I also have the means and the opportunity. So I have the financial means, or I have the opportunity means, then the formula is becoming complete. And so we have, from a victim perspective, we have girls in affluent areas like Prospect, Kentucky, who are going online with some of the contemporary technologies, and they are selling pictures of themselves, some of them not what we would call pornographic at all, pictures of their feet. Because there are people who have an appetite for that, and they will pay for that. And we've got girls who have said, why should I go to college? I'm making more money now selling pictures of my feet than I can by going out and getting a job. So we've created structures and a culture that says the child's economic value is more important, regardless of what her current economic situation might be. So she could be a girl in, you know, an impoverished part of Kentucky or a very affluent. And because of the opportunity of the technology that we also haven't checked, we also haven't done things like age verification. We haven't done restrictions. We've got parents who are buying smartphones for kids who are as young as 8 and 10 years old. And with not a consideration of opening that child up to the portal of every pedophile in the globe.
Hi, this is Richard Nelson with the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're working to strengthen the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, man-woman marriage, and fiscal integrity. If this program better helps you to understand the issues of the day from a biblical worldview, we're glad. But we need your help. Our work here at CPC is supported by people just like you. We're here to help those in the Christian community better understand how the faith applies to all areas of life, including the moral, social, and political realms. Please consider a contribution today. Simply go to our website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org and make a donation. And thanks in advance for your support. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Gene Allard, and we are talking about child sex trafficking, not just at the international level, but right here in Kentucky. And Gene, before we started the program, I had shared with you something that I learned wasn't documented, but it's something I hear repeated, and that's that because Kentucky has the Kentucky Derby every May, it is one of the highest trafficked area for child sex trafficking in the country. But you said that that's not documented. What do we know about Kentucky and child sex trafficking? Does it happen at the Kentucky Derby?
Well, here's the problem. We can't say it doesn't, right? Because we're talking about a criminal enterprise that is extraordinarily secret. And you mentioned Jeffrey Epstein. So we're talking about, when you talk about the Derby, you're talking about people of affluence and power who have the ability to cover their deeds and keep things secret. And so, you know, the same is true again. So we can't say in the negative that it doesn't exist, but there is not the data that says that's the epicenter or that's the climactic moment in the calendar for the state of Kentucky. There have been stings that have been conducted by law enforcement on the Farm and Machinery Show. And there have been cases of child trafficking that have been identified through that, and adults as well. And so there is certainly data and case evidence to suggest that that is a congregational experience where we're talking about whether it's the stereotype boys will be boys or whether it's what happened at the farm show stays at the farm show, right? Any of those kinds of cultural conditions. What we do know about Kentucky is that we have a lot of vulnerability factors. And I just pulled some statistics. We have 33% of Kentucky children live in homes that have income insecurity. We have Kentucky is number six in terms of the highest teen pregnancy rate in the nation. Kentucky is fourth highest in teen overdoses, and that's 2021 data. Kentucky is fourth in refugee arrivals per capita. So that's another vulnerable population. And so what we have to look at, we know we have pockets of profound poverty. We know the fentanyl crisis has overtaken great parts of the state. And so what these are is what we call sort of a brewing perfect storm. For us to say, we have to be sober-minded about the fact that people will be exploited to obtain, whether it's the drugs or the economic means, or to get myself out of a situation of vulnerability. Unfortunately, we don't have a very strident anti-trafficking effort in the state of Kentucky. And I think that's an area of opportunity. Awareness, as you've mentioned, needs to continue. We need to get into the schools and be able to have conversations with children who may not call it trafficking, but they know that things are happening and they know, you know, they have the language for it. It just might not be the adult language. We have seen in the reports that have gone out of DCBS that 60% of the child trafficking cases in Kentucky are at the hands of the caregiver. And so we have to, again, look at those vulnerable families if we're going to do anything about prevention. You know, I talk often with churches who are motivated. They want to be able to help and they want to end demand, or they want to be able to work on prevention. And my answer is always the same. If you want to make a concerted effort to reduce trafficking, then support single mothers and their children, and you will make a tremendous impact. And then secondarily, but perhaps parallel, let's reach out to the men and the boys who are really struggling with pornography and their own sexual identity and how they see themselves as men, because our eyes are off the ball on that. And those two efforts would go a long way to reducing the problem, not only in Kentucky, but nationally.
What are some things that people can look for? We've got many people tuned in who are concerned about this issue. What are some signs that a child is being trafficked? What can we look for?
Well, I would say that it would be my hope that we would look for signs that a child is being groomed before they've actually been commercially exploited. The fact that the child is being wooed or seduced groomed, whatever verb is appropriate for you. That's going to look like things like the child distances from activities that they would normally have done. They withdraw from whether that's sports or clubs or the friends groups that they've had. There can be a radical change in music. It could be a radical change in the company that they keep. Their friend group changes, creating more secrecy between their family and their sort of the rest of their life. We are strong believers that parents should have full access to the social media of the child and do the work to understand what that child is doing on the phone. And the games also, the video games, because many of them are portals to communities where pedophiles will hang out. So we have to be wise and understand that the modern day recruiter, exploiter, abuser is going to go where children are. And the vast majority of children are online. And so that's the primary battleground. You know, we're not talking about the creepy guy hanging out at the playground as much as we are talking about the hundreds of people, thousands of people who are online and who are making inroads with children. You know, there was a study beginning of last year that came out, and it examined how likely is it that a child who is conversing with someone online, a stranger, but they are having a chat or direct message, and they are having a conversation with a person, over 35% of the time, that child will leave their home and go meet that person. So a third of those children, not only, we'll say 100% of those children lack the discretion, but a third of those children will put themselves in harm's way by meeting that person incarnate, live. And that is terrifying. And so we have to put the speed bumps in place by knowing where our children are, particularly online, and who they're associating with.
How can somebody get in touch with you if they wanted you to speak to their group, or if they simply wanted to donate to the Institute for Shelter Care?
Well, the website would be the best place to go, and that's just instituteforsheltercare.org. All of our contact information is there.
Jean Allert, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. God bless you, and you keep up the good work. If you're enjoying this episode, you can listen to other conversations just like this one on the Commonwealth Matters podcast. You can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe and rate us. This will help you never miss an episode and to help other Kentuckians like you benefit from this program.